Impact Leaders, the podcast on leaders focusing on impact investment and performance with purpose, supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact. And this is your host, JP Dahlman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. In today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Andrew Perry as a guest. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, good to be here.
Welcome, and thank you so much for having us.
A real pleasure.
Andrew is Head of Sustainable Investing and a member of the Hermes Strategy Group. He has over 30 years of asset management experience with a focus on equities, investment strategy, business development, leadership, and strategic client relationships. He joined the firm in 2009, initially as a chief executive and co-head of investment for Hermes SourceCap, now Hermes European Equities, becoming head of equities in 2014 and taking on responsibility for developing impact investing in August of 2016. In September 2017, he became the head of sustainable investing to reflect the commitment of Hermes to this area. And he's now leading the development of sustainable investing strategies, including thematic, ESG, impact across public and private markets that build Hermes' position as a leader in responsible investing and engagement. Anything I miss?
I think that covers quite a lot of bases there.
Good.
But basically, it's all about sustainable investing.
Perfect. So, in recent years, Andrew developed a growing interest and in-depth knowledge of the sustainable impact space, which is obviously reflected in his current role. So as it is our tradition now, we're going to start with the first question that we ask every guest, which is, Andrew, what is impact investing?
A good question, and in many ways, no simple answer. It was great actually coming into this space because I spent a lot of time asking myself that. Not just what it was as it existed, but how we could do it, particularly in public markets, because there's a rich tradition of impact investing in philanthropy, in the foundations, social enterprises, private markets. How do we actually take that sum of knowledge and translate it into public markets? I know the GIN investment is producing good returns alongside doing good for people on the planet. For us, it was all about finding exciting growth opportunities because the companies are doing good for the planet and for people. You know, very much seeing impact investing as almost like the beta of future growth, representing these exciting emerging growth opportunities for companies with the right innovation strategy to tap into to tackle some of the world's most pressing, underserved or unmet needs. So for me, it was another lens to look at the world I'd been looking at for the last 30 years and to actually really give me this sort of this vision about where the world was going and the opportunities, but also recognizing our broader responsibilities as investors to actually be good stewards of the planet, to create a more sustainable, resilient and equitable system. Not just because that's the right thing to do, but also it's actually good ultimately for our clients, you know, for our beneficiaries, so people who save through our products or pension funds who are meeting these future liabilities. Because if the world isn't sustainable, if we're not trying to transition to a net positive impact on people and planet, then the net present value of all companies' profits is going to be a lot lower.
Well, I cannot disagree with that. You mentioned that you've been kind of in the business for over 30 years.
Right? Thanks for reminding me.
Which is good experience, right? You have seen all the different cycles. You have seen the changes. So what changed, you know, for you personally to actually start focusing more on this?
Yeah,
is there a pivotal moment?
I think there were several pivotal moments, if you can have such a thing. First, obviously, coming to Hermes and learning much more about the whole responsible investing mantra. It's nearly a decade since I joined here. Hermes as a leader in that space. So I've been building on the shoulders of giants in that space. You know, the stewardship arm of Hermes makes us highly differentiated. So not just investing in, but actually then engaging with companies. And I think that's very important. We're not absentee landlords. So for me, that was a very important learning curve. I guess commensurate with that was a little bit going back to my sort of science roots and getting exposed to some friends in academia to climate change about a decade ago. And that was roughly at the time we were coming to Hermes. And then really, one, loving the science behind climate change, but actually the more I talk to leaders in the academic arena, people in NGOs, recognizing that, you know, what was going on in the climate was a truly systemic risk, and then recognizing how that was going to change the way potentially we invested, not from just a risk management perspective, but also from the emerging opportunities it could represent, and but also trying to raise awareness of that imperative to tackle some of these really major challenges that lie ahead of us. So it all sort of came together. And then the more I looked at it and the more that I then evolved into thinking about impact investing and what that meant, it was just a great, exciting opportunity to continue to evolve and adapt. What I've always been doing is trying to be a really good investor and develop good investment teams. And it's the insights that it's brought to help give you a more complete, more full picture of all the inputs into assessing a company and different assets.
Excellent. And then you mentioned the word awareness, and actually that's to remind ourselves, that's why we're doing this, right? It's to just raise that awareness for everyone else. And that's kind of one of our purposes, and the importance of, you know, relating to, in this case, you know, luckily with you, Hermes, but then the other people that can provide you with the different angles and the different perspective of what's happening in the world, right? So sometimes we're just in these silos of just pure investment, old fashioned. This is what we do. So it's basically you open your mind to everything else, right?
I think that's a really excellent point, because, and one thing that I've been really delighted about in moving into this space is how collaborative everybody is.
Yes.
I talk to my competitors. Yes. We share ideas. No, we have different definitions ultimately maybe of what impact means and how to implement it at portfolio levels. But we're much more open, much more collaborative, because ultimately we have a common purpose. We want to create a better set of outcomes for people on the planet. So that's great. But also I've discovered, you know, that there's a rich source of information from talking to NGOs, from talking to academics, and talking to social entrepreneurs. I'm really impressed by the number of millennials, for example, I've met, who are actually not just advocating for a better world, but actually getting out and setting up companies with a very different perspective on profit motivation. You know, that they very much see social purpose or environmental purpose possibly ahead of profit. So this rich vein of people that I've met, and I found that I found that quite uplifting. It sort of helped, you know, give me a much better view of the people on this planet, and the recognition that many people really do want to make a change.
Yes, and also another point you made, which is in the little as well, that, you know, or as much as I have been learning about it, so the last decade has been, or just maybe over a decade has been, kind of observed and seen a real change on what's happening, right? So through climate change, through the private exercises and efforts on the philanthropy side, or some of the documentaries that have been coming out. So there is, you know, quite a lot more right now than what there was before.
Yeah, well, just look at the success of the Blue Planet. David Attenborough has really captured imagination over ocean plastics. It'd been a long-term problem, but it sort of galvanized companies, individuals into action. And that's brilliant. And I think it's that there's a moment in time when these things really begin to, create their own momentum. And it does feel like we're at that point. And if you think about some of the bigger issues, you mentioned climate, but there are transitions in the climate going on, becoming much more obvious to people in their sort of almost day-to-day lives. Transitions in technology, which is changing the way we live our lives, the way we work, for the good and for the ill. There's transitions in global trade, sort of geopolitics. There are transitions in demographics around the world, and they're all creating this uncertainty, and they're also creating threats, but also huge opportunity. So, you know, if you're an investor, trying to understand that melange of competing factors is really important. And recognizing that, yeah, I guess ultimately, look, we want to invest in sustainable businesses. And, you know, to have a sustainable business, we want to have sustainable financial returns, sustainable franchise, cash flows, margin, growth opportunities. And the only way that they're going to have that over the long term is to have sustainable social and environmental licenses to operate. And I think the one thing that I've actually come to recognize is that all companies are social enterprises. Mm-hmm. You know, whether they're the largest companies quoted on Wall Street or they're a genuine social entrepreneurs looking not for profit, but looking to make a real impact on people's lives. Companies have a huge potential force for good because they touch so much of the global economy.
Yes. On that note, let's just mention, I like, you know, talking a little bit about the companies that are supporting in this case, you know, you mentioned the social aspect of what we do. And in a way, you know, Hermes Investment Management is doing that. And you mentioned as well that it was one of the kind of the pivotal parts, you know, on your career as you were more involved. So I'd like to just share for the benefit of people that do not know as much about Hermes, that just a little bit about the background of the company. So it was established in 1983. So you have been around for a while. And again, just a bit of a history, which was set up as a principal manager to the BT pension scheme, which is an interesting fact that, you know, many people may not know. And right now, actually, you have, you know, 200 employees. You have,
I think it's over 400
yeah. Actually. And you have offices in London, Singapore, New York. You manage over 33 billion of assets in pounds. Engage, you mentioned that before, over 389 billion, as I have it here in my notes. And is majority owned now by an American company called Federated Investors, who on their own right manage, you know, 459 billions of assets. So it's a pretty kind of sizable and established company. But at the same time, as you mentioned, you have been kind of having a long-standing focus on the ESG evolution and long-term investment. You mentioned engagement services, which is something that you particularly have as an extra or, you know, something that makes it, you know, especially as an investment management company, which I think it was. And then you had the dedicated stewardship business as well.
Which the stewardship and engagement.
Yeah,
the same
which was founded in 2004.
Yeah,
so
that's correct.
You know, a bit 20 years after or so. And then this one specific fact that I picked out, which is you were founding signatories of the UN Principle of Responsible Investment.
Yeah, we were there at the sort of the forge of the modern ESG movement.
Yes, yes. So with all of these, so what have you been in terms of, you know, your past strategies and your current strategies? What is changing and what is at the core of Hermes right now?
Yeah, I think from what you described there, you know, about our history, you know, we were originally a pension fund, you know, the BT pension scheme. And I think there was a couple of great advantages of that. You know, our original CEO, Ralph Cortino, wanted us to be, you know, a responsible investor. And by that, he meant not just to produce attractive long-term risk-adjusted returns for the, you know, the beneficiaries of the BT pension scheme, but to actually recognize the way that we invested and the behaviors of the companies in which we invested had a broader impact on the world around us, and we have to recognize that and play our role in encouraging the best behaviors and outcomes. Also, by being part of a pension scheme, I think it imbued us with a much longer-term time horizon than the market, maybe.
Yes.
And if you look at the way that we invest, generally all our teams have very low turnover, long ownership periods. And I think that's really very important. It's been sort of an important part of the DNA. We'd always taken seriously our responsibilities to be engaged owners, so i.e. voting and engaging with companies. You mentioned the creation of Hermes Equity Ownership Services, which we call EOS, in 2004, so before the PRI came into formation. We were chaired the working group, I believe, into the formation of the PRI and were the founding signatories.
And which is fascinating, by the way, because it just shows, you know, how much you are involved, right? So,
yeah, and you know, we've been doing it for a while, but that doesn't mean what we did then is what we do now. Yes. We're constantly trying to develop and evolve. We're all learning more, and once you stop learning, that's the time to retire. And in fact, you know, even when you're retired, you should carry on learning. Yes. It keeps you young. But, you know, so I think we should always be adapting. I think the stewardship angle is one of our, you know, very differentiated characteristics, because, you know, stewardship is really, you know, about making a lot of these beliefs real. So where a company isn't, we think, meeting those standards on behaviors and outcomes, then we should be engaging on behalf of our beneficiaries to create a better outcome. And in fact, you can almost think in public markets that engagement is the only real true form of impact, because by engaging with companies, you can change behaviors that deliver outcomes around targeted positive impacts. Mm-hmm. And that can be across a whole range of different areas. And I think that's one of the ways that we've been thinking about evolving, is that historically, engagement tended to be around process, procedure, risk.
I was just going to ask you about the practical part of it.
Yeah,
yes.
And governance. But now you can begin to use the language of impact, sustainability, SDGs to think about much more outcomes-based. So what are you actually really trying to achieve? What are the priorities? And so, you know, this is what I mean about constantly thinking about how you can improve and push the envelope, particularly as the interest in these big topics, as represented, say, by the SDGs, become much more mainstream. People recognize that, frankly, ESG is not about non-financial matters. They're all financial matters. Mm-hmm. It's just about the time horizon over which you look at things. So, you know, for us, stewardship is very important. It really means that, as I used that phrase before, we don't want to be absentee landlords. And, you know, by having done it as a sort of business for now 15 years, I mean, I think we're getting pretty good at it. But we're constantly improving, expanding in that area. And I think one of the most important things is that the industry generally is now beginning to recognize the importance of engagement. So no longer we're never quite a lone voice. We've got always quite a few engaged owners, but increasingly passive managers are recognizing that beyond low cost access to the markets, engagement is one of the things that they can bring. And as big owners of shares, then actually engaging with the company is a way that they can bring an additional positive benefit. So I think, hopefully, we've helped encourage this trend, and it's good to see that the industry is now much more awake to the power and benefits of engagement, climate change being the most obvious area where there is an increasing coalition in the industry to try and encourage and drive change.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because you mentioned about collaboration in another question previously, right? And engagement has collaboration right behind it, right? It's all about sharing best practices, you know, at the basis of it.
Yeah, the more that we can talk with a common voice, the more that we will encourage change. But and it is really important, because if we want to create this better system, you know, to have a ecosystem in which we live and work, you know, it's about better planetary outcomes, better, you know, social outcomes. We have to recognize that because it's a complex ecosystem, we can't do it on our own. Mm-hmm. It's about everybody. So it's about the behavior of governments, the behavior of regulators, the behavior of companies, the behavior of investors. And very importantly, it's the behavior of individuals.
Yes.
So we have to all recognize that it's not just about a input, supply side. It's about the demand side as well. So, like climate change, we can talk about changing the behavior of the big oil, but if you then jump in your gas-guzzling car to go home, then you're not playing your part by thinking about the demand side. So that's why, as well, I think podcasts like this are great, because it's all about trying to encourage and educate, trying to get across the message that we all have a part to pay. And if we don't play our part, then things won't change.
Yes.
And that's what really it's about, is about changing the future for a better set of outcomes.
Yes. And just for context, so that people understand, so you manage, several billions, but specifically on pure impact right now, how much do you have allocated to?
So our two newest products were launched in December last year. December 2017. Time's rushing past.
Yeah.
And we now have nearly $600 million across those two strategies. And we've been really delighted by the response from third-party clients.
Okay. And then it's interesting because, again, for context, so that would be, kind of small portion of the total you currently manage, but at the same time, through the engagement services, you actually have a reach which is far beyond that, and that maybe some people don't realize.
Yeah, and as I mentioned earlier, I think our experience in the two impact strategies, so the products we run are something called impact opportunities, which is investing in impact, so that's investing in impactful companies with products and services designed to address underserved or unmet needs, so what I referred to earlier as the beta of future growth, so exciting innovators in emerging industries. So for us, that's a really interesting product. And then the other product, its sister product, is the SDG engagement strategy, which is investing for impact by the way that we engage with small and mid-sized companies around the world that possibly haven't fully thought about what the SDGs represent to them as a set of opportunities. Both to improve, drive returns, but also to manage risk. And so we can therefore engage with companies around targeted SDG outcomes to deliver, positive impacts over time. So investing in and investing for impact. But they're great experience because, as I said, we're building on both of those products on the shoulders of giants. The great work we've been doing on ESG integration across all our products, and we've got some really long-standing products in global equities that have been doing ESG integration for over a decade. And then on shoulders of our stewardship side, with $500 billion under advice for a broad range of pension funds and asset owners around the world. And then it's a feedback loop.
Yes.
It's each is reinforcing the other. So again, it's that learning curve, that development that I find particularly exciting about these areas.
Which is a model that I guess everyone should be trying to replicate in a way, right?
Yeah, that's like my point about don't ever stop learning, don't ever stop being open. That's what's good. The future is the future is the place really we're investing in, and that's why for me, as an active manager, somebody who picks a limited number of stocks, I really want to buy tomorrow's winners today. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, the index is yesterday's growth stories that you buy today, and many of those growth stories have potentially unsustainable future outcomes because of the transition in energy and health in lots of these different areas. So for me, actually, one of the great advantages of more impactful ways of investing and engaging is dragging your time horizon out to the future and trying not to look so much back over your shoulder. It's looking forward is the key.
Okay. Now, if we move into kind of your clients and your investors, so can you share with us a little bit about, who are they and what are they looking for these days when they come and talk to you?
Yeah, so we have a broad range of clients, both geographically, and by nature and structure. So we would sort of view them as sort of institutional, so pension funds and insurance companies, and then the more sort of private wealth, discretionary wealth, which we private wealth managers managing money on behalf of individuals. To be honest, at the end of the day, there's always a person at the end of the value chain, yes, whether it's a pension fund or whether it's somebody that has a holding in one of our UCITS funds. So,
by the way, a lot of people seem to don't understand or just forget that we are all owner of everything, right?
Yeah, and you know that, and it is important to remember, yes, we don't. Yes. It's not our money.
Yes,
not whether it is our money in there because we put our own money in, yes, but the vast majority of it is always somebody else's money, and that's an important part of what Hermes has always recognized. I'm looking at our pledge to put our clients first, which is sitting on the shelf just behind you. I think that's a very important part of what we're about, is that recognition we're investing on behalf of other people and for the long term. But what's really interesting about that is the evolving interest in ESG and sustainability and impact. You know, it's no longer seen as a niche area. In fact, one of my European clients once said, if you're not doing ESG, you have no hope in hell of ever winning a mandate in Europe. Mm-hmm. Increasingly, in the United States and in Asia as well, that's becoming the case as well, because everybody recognizes now that at the end of the day, ESG investing is just finance 101. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not looking at companies, if you're not looking at how a company manages its energy inputs, how it manages water, how it accesses non-renewable commodities, what it thinks about waste management, you're investing in companies that are probably going to have lower or certainly more volatile margin structures. Companies that don't think enough about staff turnover, absenteeism, strike rates, diversity, or worse, death and injury rate in their businesses, are going to end up with lower productivity, and then add over the top social opprobrium, you know, as social norms change, and then you have social media as a mechanism for reinforcing that. You know, the S is just part of, you know, your return structure. And then governance, well, we've always known, mm-hmm, that badly governed companies, badly managed companies ultimately destroy shareholder value through their own hubris. So these are just part of the input that you should always be looking at. That's why I refer to them as Finance 101. Every company has a set of ESG risks, including Hermes, and we have to think about and manage those two better. So increasingly, I think there's a recognition that ESG is just really good finance. So I see that in America, where maybe a few years ago, you might have found it harder to engage in the conversations. Now, lots of people are asking us to tell them what ESG means, what the benefits are, and how to do it, because they recognize that there's both a push and a pull.
Yes.
There's a push from, you know, from regulation, but also returns, and there's also a pull from their clients saying, this is how we want to invest. And people then want to know how you go beyond ESG, and that's where stewardship is becoming increasingly something people want to talk about, but also then the notions of sustainability and impact and that forward looking. How does it make you have sort of more positive choices, more positive selection in portfolios? And I think that's always an important topic because, as you'll know, things like ESG investing have been around for quite a while, but I think for many, particularly pension funds, they have this association with the old SRI exclusions base, so negative, mm-hmm, screening. And we know that the one thing about being successful, I think, in investment is that you need to be positive. You need to be positive and forward-looking. So by just excluding things, that was never going to just be an automatic sinecure for performance, you know, excluding sin stocks. You know, you need to use this approach as a way of thinking about the opportunity set rather than limiting the opportunity set. So, for example, in our impact opportunity strategies, we don't really have any exclusions, but you're not going to find drink, tobacco, armaments, big oil, heavy chemicals and all that, because they don't have a net positive impact and they're not sort of purposeful companies in the sense of what we're trying to achieve in impact. You know, they don't necessarily represent the most exciting future growth opportunities either. So it was a really interesting way of actually tackling the problem of, you know, how do we be positive? Well, if you look at demand, where's the demand going in the economy? And that's why we think it's such an exciting way to invest.
Sorry. And I was thinking about, I like analogies. It's like having a vegetable patch, and you just have the rotten plants, and you just take the rotten plants, and then you just don't replace them, right? Or you have a complete change on what people want to eat, and then you just keep planting the same plants. I don't know, just to keep it simple. And then obviously you mentioned about, millennials before and kind of a bit of the push in terms of behaviors and values, right? So the people are looking to see the values represented in what people or what companies produce, you know, what they're using, and obviously that's another point. And I think also there are the business models that are changing for both reasons, right? So what is happening in the market, all the different factors that you mentioned, and obviously we have to look ahead and try to see those businesses that are changing the business so that they can sustain over time. I thought I'd just make a note on that.
Yeah, but I think so, there is an interesting sort of point in that business models are changing. And, I think we've spent a lot of time thinking about stranded assets, but there's stranded business models. So we've got the classic Schumpeter creative destruction going on, and it's accelerating. You know, those four forces I talked about climate, demographics, technology, and global trade. You can add in the fifth of social norms changing. That probably comes under demographics. You know, they're really challenging a lot of business models. And we're beginning to see companies with redundant business models and struggling to work out how they do that. You know, I was actually at a dinner and I met a senior partner from a law firm who was saying millennials just will not work the 100-hour weeks that you used to see in the John Grisham novels. Yeah. And people are beginning to recognize that they do need to have different working models, and that's not necessarily going to be bad for productivity. And so, so the millennial effect is not, is more pervasive than we sometimes see.
It's not all that bad.
Yeah, and that's what I've been really delighted when I go out and meet people outside my sort of core constituency, if you like, and meet some of these more social entrepreneurs, is just how innovative they are. They're very happy to have completely different ways of working, and they just have a vision of the future, not just clinging to the past.
And two things I thought about as you were, sharing some of these thoughts. So one was, if I'm an investor and, I talk to quite a few people that are looking for kind of inverted commas, impact investment funds, right? And you mentioned about ESG as common sense and common practice. And as I go through what is out there right now and researching, I start finding a little bit more and more these so-called impact investment funds. But when you look, into it, is, what people actually say is just an ESG fund. Would you have anything to share in terms of, if I'm an investor, if I'm looking for that, obviously, they can come to you, but if they're looking at what is out there in the market right now, labeling themselves as impact investment, how do you discern and how do you differentiate between a pure traditional ESG investment fund and an impact fund?
Well, it's one of the great doyens of this whole sustainable investing world is Mark Campanelli. So he's been around for a long time, created the Carbon Tracker, good friend and a bit of a visionary. And I think Mark has a great definition for the difference between ESG and impact investing. And I wish I could claim it was my own, but I always have to say it's Mark's. Good. And that is that ESG is what keeps me up at night. Impact is what gets me up in the morning.
Oh, beautiful.
And it is. It's a lovely, succinct way of doing it. Now, look, there's no one interpretation of what impact or ESG even looks like. Growth and value investing were created way back in the 1930s. Yet if you have a whole range of value investors and growth investors, they will still have a different interpretation. So worry too much about standardizing everything and cookie cutting it into the same shape. You know, there must be room for personal interpretation. Now, that does make it hard, especially for individual investors to recognize what good is. But then that's true on a value product, a dividend product, a growth product. I think they just, you have to, the one thing I would say is you always have to do the sniff test. You have to look at the holdings. And most people now, and if you're buying a fund, you know, there's a disclosure of what the holdings are. And you know, if there's a whole bunch of things in there that don't align with your values and purpose, then it's not for you. I think you have to really understand as well what the intent and purpose the manager has. How clear are they in what they're trying to achieve? And then how aligned is their actual portfolio with that? You know, so for us, we did spend a lot of time genuinely arguing about what impact meant. Could we even do it? Because in public markets, capital is already allocated. Purpose has been set maybe a couple of hundred years ago, because some companies have been around a long time. So you have that additionality problem and sometimes the intentionality. So that's why, for example, our impact opportunities strategy only owns 30 stocks. We frankly don't think there are that many purposeful companies with attractive growth profiles that we want to buy at today's price because they've got long-term growth opportunities. So, you know, we deliberately wanted to set the bar very high. We wanted to build a really great global equity product as well. And then we wanted to have a really good impact narrative. Very clear reporting. So hopefully our investors like our quarterly and half-yearly reports, because we try to set out the narrative, explain a bit about each stock or one of our nine investment themes to go into that in more detail. Or in our SDG engagement fund, use case studies to show the sort of engagement that we're doing and the outcomes that we're trying to achieve. There's no easy way. You know, and I'm not, it's not, you know, and I'm not saying there is a right way. There has to be a way that works for that manager that is clearly not impact washing, and it should be about what their purpose and what they actually hold in there. You know, so one has to feel comfortable with it. You know? But we shouldn't forget as well that our job is to be first and foremost good investors.
Yes.
You know, that sometimes is where I think people can lose sight of the fact that, you know, I can't create a global equity product with an impact label on and say, well, look, it's going to do great things for people. It's going to do wonderful things for the planet, but it's going to underperform every year for the next 10 years. But you don't have to worry about that because it's doing good things. That's not going to wash. You know, my baseline is I have to use this as a way for, yes, doing things that are going to lead to better outcomes for people and the planet, but actually as a way also of identifying those winners because they have products and services aligned with tackling underserved needs. And that's why they're going to grow more rapidly than the market and represent attractive investment opportunities. So I do have that duality.
Yes.
And it shouldn't be a conflict because it's just about having that conviction and commitment to being a really good long-term investor. You know, as I say, we want to buy leaders in nascent industries. You know, these are industries that are tackling underserved needs. If they're underserved, they're growth opportunities. Yes. If they're highly served needs and disruptive, then they could be ex-growth opportunities. So, again, it comes down to a relatively simple approach. You know, that's why, you know, sustainable investing is not about, as some people in parts of America might think, it's sort of like a socialist activity.
Yes.
It's not political at all. It's about actually good allocation of capital for the long term to make attractive returns and to tackle, you know, growth opportunities.
Okay. So in terms of, to kind of paraphrase a little bit of that, in terms of selecting these 30, you know, 30 plus stocks, you basically look at, you know, this is kind of what they're serving, the growth stories, kind of all the basics that you would actually look at, you know, when selecting any other business, right? So there's nothing in particular aside from all the other kind of social impact and other intentionality and additionality that they may have, right? So that would be in summary.
Yeah, it's got to be a detailed, in-depth approach, and you want to look at it from every angle possible. So these companies have to have really good ESG characteristics. So we can't say, oh, this company's really, say, really green and doing something really great for the environment, but it's using child labor in its value chain in West Africa. That's not really going to wash. If the companies are using aggressive tax avoidance schemes by using offshore centers and don't really pay an appropriate level of tax, then they're not actually helping society, so they might get omitted. It's trying to put the bar quite high. You know, we look at products that might be viewed as sort of green and say, well, but they're not really impactful on a net basis. It is challenging. And sort of, and then they have to be attractively priced. They have to have the cash flows. They have to have the business models, you know. It is a sort of a totality that you have to look at.
So is there an example that you can share with us of, you know, one of these companies within your portfolio?
I'll pick one that we own both in our impact opportunity strategy, but we also own in our global ESG fund. It's a European company called Ørsted. But this is a really interesting example because Ørsted was originally known as DONG Energy, which stood for Danish Oil and Natural Gas. So most people would go, you can't have an oil and gas company in an impact fund. And quite, would agree. But they got taken private a number of years ago. And when they came back to the market, they came back with a new business strategy. They were using their expertise in offshore oil and gas to transition to being an offshore wind company. Mm-hmm. So offshore wind is one of the most reliable forms of alternative energy. And they're well on that transition path. You know, they've got a commitment to be at 90% by 2023. I think they're well ahead of it. I think in 2017, they produced something like 50% of Britain's alternative energy. So it's the Hornsea wind farm. If you fly in from Europe into the city airport on a sunny day, you'll see it below them. Yeah. They've opened up a new wind farm in the North Sea, and they're doing the Hornsea extension. The more they do, the more efficient they get, and the more competitive then offshore wind becomes. You know, so for us, that's a classic example of a business that is in transition, looking to the future.
Yeah. They've changed their business model.
They've changed. They've disposed of their upstream oil and gas. They still have some oil and gas exposure in their utilities in Denmark, which they wanted to get rid of, but they're moving that towards biomass. So this is a great example of a company changing its net positive impact, positioning for the future, and has been a good performer in across our funds.
Fantastic. And now if we talk about kind of measuring or reporting that impact that they generate, right? So you mentioned that you have some case studies, but do you actually produce some specific reports with some KPIs?
Yeah, so you're right to bring up the concept of measurement and reporting because I think it's probably the most challenging area for impact investors.
And we get asked that a lot, by the way. So we need to actually find somebody that is an expert at measuring and reporting for one of the coming podcasts. So we'll ask your name for that one.
Yeah. So and there are lots of people who are doing lots of really interesting work in that area, but it's still a nascent area. You know, it's still hard in ESG. But the consistency and quality of ESG data, despite the volume of activity in that area, is still not as good as we'd all like it to be. It's not standardized, it's not consistent, and with different service providers giving you different answers. So we should always recognize that impact data is going to be even less perfect. So, for us, it's about, starting with inputs, moving on to outputs, looking at outcomes, and then analyzing impact. I think it's very important not to conflate impact achieved with ESG outputs. And it is different. We spend a lot of time thinking initially about what our impact narrative is, and I still think it's very important to not lose sight of the narrative. What's the company doing? What's its purpose? What is it trying to achieve? looking at our tests around the nature, the centrality and the additionality, tensionality and balance within a business. These are all the sort of things that we look at to as the starting point before we even buy a company. In the case of the engagement side, setting clear goals related to specific outcomes that can be then reported on and measured over the time. Now, I can understand that there's a lot of desire to put a dollar value on impact. Mm-hmm. And in some cases and some areas, you can potentially do that. Actually, wind is quite a good one. But again, it has to be in the context sometimes of geography. So you can have even more impact with wind, not in the UK. So the UK versus the US is very different to India and China because of the level of health and pollution. So you can use it as a framework for understanding the benefits. The challenge we have with a lot of these things is that the companies aren't reporting the data. So we have one company that we wrote to recently who are involved in battery technology, and we asked them about their carbon avoided, because of course the move to electric vehicles is all about avoiding carbon. And they said, we don't have a measure yet, not a measure that we rely on, that we feel we can rely on and report without being accused of greenwashing. So therefore, we have a challenge. We'd like to report that number, but I'm not going to make a number up or estimate a number if the company can't do it. Yeah. And so we've been talking to industry experts. I met a professor who does this sort of analysis for the car industry. He said, I can spend a year on looking at one production line. And that's a lot of hard work. When I try to aggregate it up to the total company level, we're still a long way away. So, you know, I think there's a lot of innovative thinking. Some of it's incomplete. It's important that we don't just measure positive outcomes. We have to look at negative outcomes. We have to look at the rebound effect. Are you changing behavior that leads to then further down the line negative outcomes? Which is why, you know, I'm not keen on rushing to do an aggregate impact score on our portfolio. This is why we do case study, you know, company by company, set out a clear theory of change, set out what we think the company's the areas it's tackling, the impact risks that are associated with, the chance of them not achieving that. Look at the negatives. Where we can, we will engage on those negatives. There's even Ørsted can improve in areas, and we talk to them about that. And for me, that's very important. So we're doing our first annual impact reports for both, you know, both strategies. We're going to be talking about that. Yes, we will have some aggregate statistics, but really they're more ESG. They're more about the exposures. Yes. And just to give some really interesting facts about the portfolio in aggregate. But essentially, it's about really what each of the individual companies are doing. And the way I think about it is that a quality job in Detroit or Doncaster is not the same as a quality job in Dar es Salaam or Delhi. And trying to add these things up, I think, sometimes takes us away from the impact rather than towards the impact. Mm-hmm. So I might be a bit controversial in that statement because I know there's a desire to measure everything. But, you know, so if you can measure it, you can manage it is the you know, the aphorism. The danger and something we have to be careful about in this industry is if you can measure it, you can manipulate it. Mm-hmm. So I'm because we put a high standard on our assessment of impact, we want to put a high standard on our impact reporting and measurement. So we want to only report on what can be measured and what the company is demonstrating rather than using estimations. I can see that there is some desire for that, but this is why we're encouraging better corporate reporting. Because remember, it's not us as investors doing the impactful activities. It's actually the companies. So we want the companies to be reporting data that is around the impacts that they're having, both positive and negative, reporting as well ESG data, if you like, that's relevant to their strategy. How are these things integrated into their business? How is it integrated into their allocation of capital within their business? We don't really want to be measuring a whole bunch of statistics that the CEO, the finance director aren't really paying any attention to because they're not material or in their business. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, it there's a lot of work to be done still, and we hope to play our part in evolving and developing that.
Yes. So I guess that people just want to have some kind of clarity and something that they can hold on to, and something that, you know, what I hear, you know, basically by interviewing a few of the people we have interviewed through the podcast, is that there is no one common denominator yet. There is no guidance. And somebody else offline, we were talking about, there is potentially the need for, once we have this guidance, this commonality, is some auditing around it. Because, you know, that's how you know if it is true, who are reporting, where are they reporting, right? Which we're not there yet.
No, we're a long way from it. You know, a lot of the ESG data that's reported is sort of not audited. It's not, you know, part of the financial statement. And I'm beginning to think that maybe, and this is, you know, a view that is my own, that when you look at ESG data and this problem of lack of consistency across the data providers, it does become a challenge for companies. You know, for many of them, they're producing loads of spreadsheets every month on different data for different, you know, firms, you know, whether it be actual investors or index providers or, you know, ESG data providers. And that's quite overwhelming. So perhaps just standardizing the reporting, as we standardize cash flow reporting and other accounting items, might actually be easier for companies in the end. Because instead of doing 30 spreadsheets a month on data that might not be relevant to them, they can actually report the material factors and issues in their business. And then that would maybe encourage them to report more and more clearly, if they're not being overwhelmed by reporting a plethora of information that's not always linked to what they see as the material opportunities or risks in their business.
Perfect. I have one question within this area, which kind of I'm trying to link it to what we were talking about, but I can't. But so I'm going to ask you anyway, because it's something you mentioned in another interview, which was around sustainable modes and creating sustainable modes. And I think that it relates a little bit through everything we've been talking to today. So anything you can share with me about that, because it's still in my mind. When you talk about sustainable modes, I think you quote Warren Buffett, right? So what is it that we need to create? Or that's everything that we're doing in terms of trying to report and measure impact, etc., helps for that?
Yeah, you know, there's no one solution to this. I mentioned we take it as like an ecosystem. And the financial world is an embedded part of a broader ecosystem. So we're not looking at this as overlapping Venn diagrams and there's this nice sustainable bit in the middle. It's all part of creating a more sustainable system, which is why narrative words are actually very important, that ability to articulate what you're doing and why, set out a vision so that doubters might embrace the opportunity. Because that is still a big challenge. You know, there are, you know, a lot of people probably of my generation who have that legacy memory of SRI not having worked very well. Especially when I go in to talk about impact, pension funds will go, oh, that's all about putting social and environmental returns ahead of financial performance. Well, you can do that if you're a social entrepreneur. You might very well choose to do that. If you're an NGO, you might have a completely different model, and foundations might have a different approach. You know, when you get to our world, it's actually, well, what does it represent as a set of opportunities? So I tend to think about it as like a four-pillar approach to how we do this. And I think it's important to put it in the context of what either an individual saver or a pension scheme is trying to achieve in their particular set of circumstances. And, you know, so my four pillars are around what does sustainability represent as a series of growth opportunities. You know, so whether it's transitions in energy, in healthcare, in the food security, circular economy, et cetera. Because these are all really exciting emerging growth opportunities. And you can invest in them in public or private markets. And so they can be at market or above market even. You can think of it through the lens of risk. So what do sustainability issues, SDGs even, represent as risk? So they can be around that notion of systemic risks, so climate change and demographics, so these are the stranded assets, but also around specific risk, i.e. company risk, which is stranded business model. So it gives you a better, more complete picture of risk going forward. So it's always that forward looking. The third pillar is then around stewardship, which is about voting, engaging, public policy advocacy, and hopefully playing our small part today, education. And I think that's very important,
yes, education,
your colleagues, your clients, the marketplace, regulators, et cetera, to try and change behaviors and deliver better outcomes. And then the fourth is clear, transparent reporting about what exposures you have and why. And that includes costs and charges, what's going on in your business. At Hermes, we aspire to all four. You know, I think we want, I want to do more in reporting in particular. And I think that's the where the evolution is going to be the most rapid. Some schemes I talk to really, because of the nature of what they are, maybe very underfunded and, you know, they don't have much cash flow, they might focus on the growth opportunities that sustainability represents. Some schemes just focus on the stewardship angle because they're so big, they feel that, you know, they have a lot of index. So how can they change the system through the way they engage with their broad book of index holdings? Others might view it as a risk opportunity. So the good thing is it allows you to be flexible and reflect your resources. And I think that is very important at the moment in trying to make sustainability not seem prescriptive. It has to go from answering the why question, which I think Hermes has been very good at, you know, answering in our own form, and I think it's pretty well established now that this is something that we need to do if we're not going to do lasting harm to our planet, but also to our wealth. But we have to think about what this means practically, and that's what pension funds particularly ask me. How do we make this a practical reality and not seem like some ideology or just greenwashing? And for me, that's why it is ultimately about being a good investor as well, because it gives you that better insight.
And effectively, now I understand analogies around you protecting yourself, you know, sustainable over time, and you protect your assets and your returns, etc., by looking at these four pillars.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's not be under no illusion that if we have 3 degrees of climate warming, the net present value of all our savings is going to be considerably lower.
Yes. So this brings us, and actually I'm glad I asked that question because I thought it brought us to a nice point to move now into the future. Right? So if we look into, you know, where we're going, so what are the biggest hurdles you have been facing to promote impact investing kind of internally, externally, and how would we... what would it take to convince all fund managers within their respective firms to embrace responsible investing, impact investing?
I think the industry is in change. You know, if you actually do a word search for ESG, responsible investing, impact, and you do it across the industry, you find these words leap out at you in terms of the volume. So the main thing is making sure it goes beyond rhetoric to action. For me, as I think I keep repeating, the real appeal for it for all the mainstream investment houses is it just represents a set of opportunities. It makes you more complete, more rounded, more aware of you know future investment opportunities rather than dwelling on the past.
Yes.
You know, I'm biased. I'm an active manager. I always have been. You know, my view is I get paid to be different to the index, not to cling to it. So the decisions that we make, not just in our impact strategy, but in all our strategies, is about being different to the index. If you're on the index, you're going to go and buy it very, very cheaply. So for me, this is about a justification of good active management, which is about selectivity, which is about the future. So it's about that sort of outcome. I think...
And you mentioned, sorry, just one second, you mentioned energy, for example, as one of your examples. Is there any other area or sector that is the kind of where we have the biggest interest right now?
Yeah, well, obviously in healthcare, but you mentioned energy because there's a good point about actually how I think this can be used. And when you look at energy, a lot of people will talk about excluding oil and gas assets. And that's fine. You know, I can see the logic of that, if it's particularly around purpose. But we have to remember that oil and gas demand is still growing, which is a bit worrying. And so governments need to play their role. But if you actually begin to think about these problems, not through the lens of supply, but through the lens of demand. So I look at big oil companies. And I look at their long-term future demand profile. And I don't know when it's going to roll over and turn negative. But you probably have a strong conviction that if you take a long time horizon, maybe 10 years, that they will all go X growth. What price do you want to pay for an asset today that you know with a high degree of confidence is probably going to be X growth in the future and could increasingly be subject to higher taxes, regulatory concerns, etc.? So for me, if I look at it through that demand lens, it becomes a lot simpler. They become less appealing. And as an active manager picking a relatively small number of stocks, they sort of don't rise to the top of my list. So for me, that's where sustainability and impact has really, really helped, I think, in terms of just understanding better these dynamics. All companies have a series of impacts on the people and planet, complex series of positive and negatives. Net balance is almost certainly negative. We know that because of the direction of travel, in the climate, let alone in the environment on the ground itself. So for me, it's about recognizing that transition, that are the responsibility of companies to actually increasingly operate within planetary boundaries. Mm-hmm. To recognize that creating more inclusive opportunities to be more have equitable opportunities. It's not equality is not going to be it's not something you can achieve perfectly, but you can have a quality of opportunities. Actually, ultimately, good for demand. It's one of the quotes I like to give from John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address in January 1961. If a free society cannot help the many that are poor, it cannot save the few that are rich. I think that's a good phrase to actually think about some of the challenges today and why impact investing is important and looking at the impacts companies and individuals have. Because if you think about what's happened since the global financial crisis, many of the divisions and inequalities in society have not got better, they've actually got worse. Mm. The top 0.5% of wealth owners in the world own an extraordinary amount of the assets. Now, if that continues, how much demand is there going to be if we're all going to be the gardeners, cooks, service providers to the few trillionaires that exist? It's not, for me, it doesn't represent a dynamic system doesn't for future demand. So it's it's understanding that we do need to reflect this. And I think companies, it comes back to that point, companies are social enterprises. They're beginning to recognize that. And so therefore it's language that can be used in all different products. Now, being truly impact products, I would say not everybody sort of can be, because there's a limited number of truly purposeful, mission-led, net positive impact companies in the world. But what the interest in impact will generally do is help encourage business model transition. So that's part of what, I'm co-chair of the UNEP FI Positive Impact Initiative. And we want to get companies to think about impact-enabled business models as a way of future growth, not just achieving the SDGs. So I think it's about a language that helps broaden the debate and change the system, albeit that not every company can be impact as we would define it today. But maybe in the next 3 years, we'll have a lot more IPOs. Companies like follow an Ørsted example and transition their business model. Change is always very good. So, for me, that's the most important thing. The interest in impact recognizes that potential. Mm-hmm. If one thing alone it does is helping to get people think about that transition in business models that's needed.
So we have generating awareness, benchmarking business models, sharing information. We have quite a few activities, actual active investment that are happening right now. Obviously, it's taking us some time to actually move, the needle. Is there anything, and actually we didn't specifically talk about SDGs as much all throughout so far, but I was going to ask you, if you want to scale and to actually achieve the SDGs by 2030, is there anything radical that we can do to try to scale up impact investment? You offline mentioned millennials do not have all the funds right now. So as much as they have, all the eagerness and intention, still the money is sitting with the pension funds, with the large investors. So how do we scale? How do we make, how do we massively move the needle?
And I think it's good to talk about the SDGs, because the SDGs are that ultimate representation of underserved unmet needs in the global economy. So I think when they were formed, it was estimated $93 trillion of cumulative spending was needed to achieve the goals, roughly half of which was new additional spending. So really, and that's one of the key things about the goals, is it's about mobilizing new capital to achieve, to tackle these underserved needs. So one of the key things is not to do SDG washing. And that is one thing that probably drives me mad, is where people relabel existing activities and claim that they tackle all the SDGs. I did see one tobacco company doing that, and that's great, isn't it? SDGs have been sold by big tobacco. It is recognizing that they are goals, they're aspirations. So not even Manchester City go onto the football field assuming that they scored 5 goals. They often do. It is something you aspire to doing, something you have to go and work and achieve through good management, good application. So that's very important to constantly recognize. We did our own SDG taxonomy that stands behind our impact opportunities. We're going to publish it on our website so people can look at the research that we did. And we think that in public markets, that only roughly 25% of the 169 detailed goals supported sub-targets and the KPIs that stand behind them can actually be tackled directly in public markets. You can get nearer to 40% if you add in engagement. A lot of them have to be done by governments, civil society, NGOs, charities, social enterprises. This is, again, we're all in it together. For us, they represented an opportunity to encourage companies to move in that direction. The big challenge is still the developing world. The financing gap for underserved needs in the developed world is still there. We still need more innovative solutions for providing some of the more pressing social and then the big systemic environmental changing climate. But Africa still has a huge problem. And Africa has a huge problem around governance quite often and for cost of finance. I guess in my role at the UNEP-FI Positive Impact Initiative, that's part of rethinking impact, is to think about rethinking the financing of impact. So it's really good that banks are beginning to recognize more the financing opportunities around impact. Insurance companies are. In Paris in December, the launch of the responsible banking and the responsible insurance principles. We need the banks, who are much more transactional, to really think about where those transactions are going. Somebody told me there were 50 stranded coal-fired power stations on the balance sheets of banks in India, where coal is still a major asset. So banks are beginning to recognize the risk, because they're seeing it appear on their balance sheets, but they're also beginning to recognize that the financing of these of the SDGs is also a huge opportunity. Now, that requires the right institutions, the innovative ways of financing around first loss and things like that. But for me, that's some of the more exciting areas. Companies through their supply chains can do an awful lot. Because if they're sourcing from the developing world, they can encourage, even more than we can as investors, they can encourage their local suppliers to maybe treat their workers a little bit better, offer them health treatment, even water and things like that, to have better policies on diversity, thinking much more about circular economy, local supply. So there's a lot of things that we can do. We can encourage that through our SDG engagement fund, which is what we're trying to do. But we can also encourage people across all our strategies to really begin to think about actually how the whole value chain can actually have an impact. Yeah. And really that's where, companies, big, Western companies can have a big influence on the developing world, is through their supply chains or through their direct operations in these parts of the world.
Thank you. Thank you. So it's a collective of actions in all different areas. So, great answer. Thank you. Yeah. So we're coming to the last part of the podcast, and I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions about you. So in simple terms, what drives you, Andrew? What inspires you?
The whole debate inspires me. I love learning. As I said, I've been doing this 30-odd years. And, it would become a drudge if you think it's just turning the handle and doing the same thing that you've always done. Mm-hmm. And what I love about this industry is it's constantly evolving dynamic. Human nature doesn't change. You can read Aeschylus or Goethe or Shakespeare or Paul Auster, and the basic drivers to human nature haven't altered in all those millennia. But look how the world's changed. Look how technology, society constantly adapts and evolves. It's that wonderful collision between the two. And it's about what the future's going to look like. So that's got to be exciting and actually helping in your small part to maybe encourage a better future is no bad ambition.
Being alive and evolving. And do you have any recommendation, or specifically a person that inspired you in the past, or a book or something that you want to share with the listeners?
I think the amazing thing is just how many inspiring people I've met. We've got great people right across the organization here. We've got great investors, passionate people. So I wouldn't say there's a sort of one person. I wouldn't say there's one book. It's like the coming together of a vision. But the people who probably inspired me most are actually some of the younger people who are just getting on and doing it. I've probably been more inspired by the people who are doing more philanthropy, doing these social enterprises for not-for-profit, and recognizing that they've got some huge innovation. But for me, the thing that's really inspired me is just the collective. I don't mean that in some sort of old-fashioned Marxist, communist sense, but in the notion that there is a collective vision that we need to evolve the system. And, that's the excitement. It's not any one individual. It's about the system change. And to have a system change, it's not about the individual, it's about that collective behavior. And there's so much going on out there. There's so much going on out there. And that's got to inspire you.
I like that. I'm a big supporter of the community, and that how we all have to work together. And I think that the bearing on the different cultures, right? But as you go back to basics again, is what makes us survive, evolve, progress, just working together. And we need to do more of that.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of the sort of focus of the counter movement around this sort of Chicago School, Milton Friedman, the only form of social responsibility is maximizing profits. Mm-hmm. I sort of reject that as a hypothesis, and I think most people do. We have that sort of benign self-interest thought. But, generally I think people do have a broader sense of the collective. And national companies are about, they're not just, and the bad ones where it's just about the CEO, don't tend to thrive in the long term. They do well maybe for quite a while, and then they explode like a supernova. So, no, I think it is very important. I come from a science background, so this is a system change, mm-hmm. and the system has to change when all the cogs and gears click into place. And so it is about that more than one moving part. It is about shifting perceptions.
Wonderful. And moving from that to the next question, which is around leadership. So, you know, what does that CEO that drives that company, or what does, you know, your experience as a leader in this company and in the market, you know, what advice do you have?
I think clarity of strategy, narrative, being open as well. You know, I definitely know I'm not the total knowledge. Mm-hmm. Is recognizing there's going to be a lot of other people out there, allowing those voices to breathe. You know, that was one of the great things about developing, for example, like the impact opportunity strategy, is bringing together people with very different mindsets. And I often use the line that we argued for 4 months. And we did. And we came to a collective view of what the best way, you know, to do this was. Not a compromise, but we were challenging each other. And the way that team set up is to challenge each person. But then you give people areas of expertise that they can build and develop. So like Maxine, who came from our stewardship side, is really developing an expertise in investment, in impact measurement and reporting. Maxime, who came from our responsibility office on impact assessment. Mohsin, who came across from our private equity area, on the thematic parts. And then Tim as our, you know, sort of the lead manager and the sort of, you know, the really great stock picker that he's always been. That they come together with these expertise, but they all have one vision, and that's the client's bottom line. Mm-hmm. And they have that. So that's really important. So what's that shared vision? And always that shared vision is about the client. It has to be about the client. So if you have happy clients, you're going to achieve the rest. And so recognizing the role of the client in that and your ability then to articulate what you're doing and why and justify it.
Yeah. And maybe also while trying to educate the clients, right? Because that's a big part of it right now with everything that we just talked about.
And for the clients who educate us, you know, I go along and have lots of conversations with lots of different people in different countries, you know, different mindsets. And even the ones who bizarrely say, I don't believe in ESG, which is a bit like odd saying, like, I don't believe in a table, I don't believe in chairs. It's sort of, you know, you still learn something from them and you try to tease out why that they have these viewpoints and what is it that is an impediment. Because you need, you know, again, if you're going to change the system, you need to change the majority of people within it. So, you know, it's a dialogue. And so it's going along to try and help the clients. So I'm not telling them what to do. And for many of them, they're telling me what they need and they challenge me. So it's been open, I think, to different ideas, open to learning. As I think I mentioned it earlier, it's time to give up when you're no longer learning.
Anymore. Okay. Thank you so much. If people want to get in touch with you personally or with the Hermes Impact Opportunities Equity Team, what is the best way to do that?
They can always send me an email, get hold of me on LinkedIn. We have a very well-developed marketing and sales team, so there'll always be somebody willing to talk to you. And, having that conversation is a big part of what I'm about. It's trying to encourage this change and to encourage a broader debate and participation in the movement towards a more sustainable system.
Wonderful. And one last call to action that you would, to try to summarize, the over 1 hour I think we've been speaking about great and wonderful things.
I guess I would use my standard conclusion. Sustainability is no longer an option. It's an imperative.
Thank you so much for your time, Andrew, and to Hermes. So anything else?
No, I think I will leave it there. It's been a real pleasure. Been delighted to be in your company, for your questions and for your support and of the impact movement. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very, very much. It's a real pleasure. So thank you so much to everyone that is listening to the podcast today. It is bye for now and until our next episode of Impact Leaders. Please remember to check our sponsors' websites, as always, especially for upcoming events. So it's fastforward2030.com and realchanges.com. Until next one. Thank you.
This was Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.